Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN in Geneva. Today is Friday, 16th of May, and it looks like we have, it's your turn to ask questions, as we don't have any active briefing from colleagues, but they are, at least some of them here, to answer questions. So I will give you the floor. Just before I do so, a couple of announcements for you. There is a press conference which has been announced, organized by the Permanent Mission of France on Tuesday, 20th of May at noon. As you know, for the Permanent Missions press conferences, this will be in person in the press room. So don't hesitate to come. The Minister of State for Francophonie and International Partnerships will be here to brief you together with the French Ambassador for Global Health and the Permanent Representative of France to the UN, the new Permanent Representative here in Geneva. Committee on the Rights of the Child is concluding the review of the report of Iraq this morning, and this will be followed by Romania, Qatar, and Brazil. I also wanted to draw your attention on the fact that tomorrow, that is, as you know, the weekend, which includes the Night of Museum in Geneva and elsewhere, we will have a nice event at the ITU. Colleagues at ITU have organized a commemoration of the 160th anniversary of the organization, 160 years of technology for humanity. There will be a light show on the Place des Nations, which will also be streamed on ITU's social media platforms. It's really to underline the importance of the work of the Vital Service, which is coordinated by ITU, which allows us to use radio, television, board the plane, call home, go online, use GPS, check the weather, and you name it. So on the World Telecommunication and Information Society Day, which is indeed tomorrow, we invite you on behalf of ITU to join the first ever light show projected into the iconic ITU tower. Lots of information on how to participate on the ITU website, but also on the UN Geneva website. The Director General of UNOG will be there together with Torin Bogdan-Martin, the ITU Secretary General, and other hosts. We've also distributed to you the Secretary General message for this day, which will also be read tomorrow, and where he says, among other things, that we need to, the Pact of the Future and the Global Digital Compact offer a path to bridge digital divides and strengthen collaboration for women's rights online. Let's take that path together and help ensure digital transformation is a force for progress, inclusion, and equality. So these were the announcements I have for you. And oh, sorry, and I see that also ITU has sent you a press release on the event. So any question for people online or in the room? Yes, Nina.
I was wondering if maybe Jens could come up.
Jens is here to answer your questions.
WHO is there? Maybe we could get...
WHO, Margaret should be online because I don't see her in the room, but she had been announced. So yeah. Let me see. Just let's start with Jens, if you wish. Let me just see if Margaret is online. No, Fadela is online.
Yes.
I don't see Margaret. Oh, here she is. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, Nina.
No, it was on the situation in Gaza. If we could have an update. I mean, the situation seems pretty dire. And yesterday we were hearing that the last hospital offering any cancer treatment in Gaza is no longer functioning. I mean, it's difficult to have specific questions. The situation is so horrific there. But if you have an update on the situation.
Absolutely, indeed. We do have updates, so I'll leave Jens. I'll give the floor to Jens to this, and then we'll hear from Margaret.
Yeah, thank you, Nina. I think it's Margaret. As you've seen, you know, the reporting, the killing of civilians continue, and at the same time, the bombing of the hospitals for the survivors are going on. So I will let Margaret say a bit more about that.
Margaret.
Yes, indeed. the European General Hospital was one of the best organized hospitals, and it was in fact the one we used when we were gathering people together for an evacuation. And that first bombing, as you probably know, destroyed two of the buses that we'd assembled to take children. These are sick children, children with cancer, children with amputations, to be evacuated. And now it is entirely out of service. It was the only hospital able to provide well-organized, systematic cancer treatment. I mean, even though we've got running out of all kinds of supplies, cancer treatment was ongoing there. So that's right. We've lost yet another component of the service for ordinary civilians needing ordinary healthcare or life-saving healthcare. If you've got cancer, you don't get treatment, your cancer will kill you. And you will also suffer enormously. Now that all the people with the intense bombardment going on overnight, and my colleagues in the Strip said it was, to use their words, a very loud night last night. The people, most of the injured, are going to the Indonesian hospital, which, as you know, was just a shell. We've done our best to bring it back together, and they are doing their best to treat everyone, but they lack everything needed to provide those supplies. And I'll just say one more thing about this continued bombardment and the effect it's having on people. Every night, every day, people are in terror. This is 2 million people in terror. And human beings are not built for endless fear. Even the strongest break under this weight of constant trauma, and really the only thing keeping people going is love. It's love of their family, the love of the people around them, the love to keep waking each day to survive without adequate food, care, or shelter. They are resilient because they still love each other. But what is killing them, what is starving them, is hate. And hate is medically harmful, not just for the people who are hated, but those doing the hating. It's harmful for them because they damage their bodies, their minds, and they induce, with their violence, they induce violence. So can we please, even in health terms, return to a little love?
Nina? It's okay? Yeah, I think I saw Jamie's hand. Is that right? Go ahead.
Good morning, Jens. Just wanted to know if OCHA has noticed whether or not any aid is being let into Gaza ahead of this starting of this foundation, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that I think you've been asked about already on a couple of occasions. The foundation says it's going to be starting in 2 weeks or before the end of the month. Just coming back to you on the same question, but I think it needs renewing, is will OCHA participate in that in any way or have any role? Will you have any role in that? They've said that they would expand to provide aid to all of Gaza eventually. Does that help attenuate or address your concerns that OCHA and the UN have made earlier? Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. To your first question, no, we have seen no aid coming in. So let me just reiterate a few points on that. On Tuesday, you saw the Emergency Relief Coordinator, Tom Fletcher, in the Security Council, spoke about this, and he called a spade a spade. The distribution modality designed by Israel that you are referring to is a cynical sideshow and a deliberate distraction. We have looked at it carefully, discussed its various iterations. The UN has had more than 14 meetings. Let me repeat that. The UN has had 14 meetings with the Israelis on the proposed new aid scheme. It excludes many, including people with disabilities, women, children, the elderly, and the wounded. It forces further displacement. It exposes thousands of people to harm. It sets an unacceptable precedent for aid delivery, not just in the occupied Palestinian territory, but around the world. it restricts aid not to only part of Gaza while leaving other dire needs unmet. It makes aid conditional on political and military aims. It makes starvation a bargaining chip. Again, it is a cynical sideshow. In this moment of acute urgency for the people of Gaza, the logical solution to improve the situation is right in front of our eyes. The plan A, the one that works. We can prove that. We have proven that. Precious time, life-saving time, is wasted with a flawed plan B. We have a better plan, designed and tested by the ones who have actually delivered aid in this conflict for 18 months, and with supplies that are already paid for by the donors. The solution is right there. Israel says that it does not allow aid to get in because they claim that it's diverted and it ends up in the hands of Hamas and other groups. Let's just have a look at what kind of aid they're so concerned about getting into the wrong hands. And we would agree that Hamas is the wrong hands. We're the first to point that out. So I have a list I received this morning of some of the aid that's waiting just outside the borders to get in. It includes educational supplies, children's bags, shoes, size 3 to 4 years old and up to 10 years old, stationery and toys, rice, wheat flour, canned beans, eggs, pasta, various sweets, tents, water tanks, cold storage boxes, breastfeeding kits, breast milk substitutes, energy biscuits, shampoo and hand soap, floor cleaner. I ask you, how much war can you wage with this?
Thank you, Jens. You partially answered my question, and I hope you're not going to take this the wrong way, but are any of those things dual-use products?
Nope. The whole list I just mentioned has been cleared by the Israelis already.
Sorry, one last thing, because we have some time today, hopefully. Can you just put us up to speed? You mentioned that was today. I mean, you mentioned the 40 meetings. I think we've heard that figure before. I'm just wondering what the really latest contact that you've had, and how can we move this forward in terms of, I mean, are we at an impasse right now in terms of, and is there not at some point where the UN, OCHA, or other agencies, they have to make come to the conclusion that any aid is better than no aid?
No, the world needs to come to the conclusion that the blockade must end, and it must end immediately. So these items, particularly food, you know, there is famine warning across the Gaza Strip, can get in. That's what needs to happen.
Indeed. I think it is pretty clear any humanitarian aid is important, but we do understand that. But we are those who are capable of delivering humanitarian aid the fastest way, the most efficient way, and that is what we need to do. And people have to approve and let us do that.
Sorry, can I just follow up? Yeah, can you just give us a readout of the last meetings that you've had with the Israelis? Anything like fresh that's new that can kind of move us forward on this?
I do not have a readout of these meetings. They are closed. So I cannot give you that. I know that there's been 14 sessions of discussion, if you like, where we have raised our concern. And as I said, we do not reject this lightly for exactly the reasons that you say. We want to get aid to people, but it has to be the right way. It has to be in a way that does not endanger civilians, and it has to be at a scale that matters, that can actually address the situation right now.
Iman.
Thank you so much. The health authority in Gaza declared, I think, this morning that 250 people have been killed yesterday and today morning. So, and this came after 3 days that Netanyahu declared an intensifying operation in Gaza. Could you comment and give some update on that, please? Thank you.
You mean update on the number of casualties? Maybe Margaret has got something on that.
Sorry, I haven't unmuted. Yes, we certainly have overnight, our numbers come from the Ministry of Health, Gaza, I should indicate. And but what I have overnight is that at least 61 people were killed overnight and early on Thursday. And then we have in Jabalia, a strike on the Al Toba medical clinic killed 15 people and wounded several others. That's the information I have, but I don't have confirmation on those exact numbers.
Merci. On a l'impression que la communauté internationale ne bouge plus. Il y a quelques mois en arrière, on sentait que les pays bougeaient plus pour faire pression sur Israël. Et il y avait aussi donc des aides acheminées par des avions, par air. Et on avait parlé aussi de cette espèce de pont entre Chypre et Gaza qui n'a pas fonctionné, ou je ne sais pas ce qui s'est passé avec. Mais aujourd'hui, il n'y a plus personne qui parle. Est-ce que vous avez des contacts avec les pays, au moins les États-Unis, qui ont une influence sur Israël, une influence vraie sur Israël, pour essayer de trouver une solution à cette impasse? Merci.
Yeah, you are absolutely right, Moussa. What we need now is action. That's clear. We have been working and pushing all the countries which have an influence or are involved in the situation in the Middle East to push for this to happen, and this includes the respect for international law, basic international norms, what Jens has said in terms of aid. We will continue to press the case because there must be a way that all the countries can come together and make sure that the violation of law of the law, including the deprivation of aid that we have seen in the last months, come to an end. So we will continue pushing. We will continue talking. We will continue having these contacts with all the countries which are involved with this situation. Waiting online, Catherine.
Oui, bonjour, Alessandra. Good morning, Jens. This is a follow-up on the question of Moussa. We've seen that UN can be, and member states can be very active for certain situations in asking member states to take resolutions, to vote resolutions, to put pressure on countries. And I have the same impression as Moussa. We have UN experts who demanded international intervention. So I'd like to know in New York, at the level of the Security Council, and in Geneva, on the level of the Council of Human Rights, which mechanisms are put into force in order to put real pressure on Israel? Is there anything? And I have a question for Margaret, but it's not related to Gaza. It is related to WHA. Thank you.
Catherine, merci. I think we've partially answered the issue that you are raising. As Jens said, there are contacts, repetitive contacts with the Israeli authorities. And when you speak about mechanism at the level of the United Nations, obviously the Security Council is the main body where everything that you know, has an impact on peace, security, conflicts is, and we have been speaking, because Jens has just mentioned the briefing that the humanitarian coordinator has given, Fletcher has given. There has been another briefing, I think it's today, that will be given on the situation in Palestine and in Gaza Strip. So we are talking, we are speaking, we are trying to convince. We are, I think, very strongly advocating. The mechanisms are there. There is, what we need is the political will. And I'll go to, but you had another question to Margaret. If you don't mind, maybe I let Margaret answer. I don't know if you want to answer both things now, or you want to wait for at the end for the WHA, Margaret, because maybe there are other questions on that.
I'm fine either way. Sorry, was there a question for me beyond the WHA? I thought it was just the WHA.
Yeah, maybe let's just wait and see the other questions, because there are many hands up. So
I'll keep the
WHA for the end, if it's okay with you. Yeah? Okay, sorry for the people in the room. People have been waiting online. I'll go to the platform again. Jeremy Lange.
Yes, thank you. Bonjour à tous. Jens, you were very clear about what you think about the plan B. Going back to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, I'd like to know, just have you ever been in contact with this foundation? Meaning, like, I suppose that you didn't contact them, but have they tried to contact the UN just to get some insight or your help in any way? And if this was the case, what was your answer?
Thank you. It's a very good question, because it's a little bit unclear whose plan this is. We have called it an Israeli-backed plan because we have been briefed on exactly the same elements that is presented from this foundation, but by the Israelis. That's that. And our position is as I laid it out. So I cannot put my finger on exactly if there was any meeting or any contact. There probably has been. But it may be formal, it may be informal. It's not something that has come to across my desk. But the bottom line is that the elements, what they are proposing, what the Israelis have told us in these meetings to the humanitarian country team, is exactly that. And that's what I'm responding to.
Beza?
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. I just want to ask Margaret about hospital attack, returning to European Gaza hospital attack. As we know, Mr. Tedros already said that it was a pre-coordinated medical transfer happening while the attack is done. I just want to ask, did you contact with the Israeli side after this? And if they give any reasoning to you, because they usually give a reasoning to the hospital attacks, saying that military usage, etc. But this time it was clear that UN was using for a medical transfer. So what is your take up on that? Thank you.
I don't have any information about conversations afterwards, but certainly all our movements are green lighted. So all our movements are known and confirmed and what you call deconflicted. You know, everybody is informed about what we're doing and they've agreed to us doing it.
Thank you very much. Just to be more precise, I was saying that not only the Security Council with Mr. Fletcher had been speaking very extensively about this, but the other meeting I was referring to is the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People. It met yesterday, and Assistant Secretary General Khaled Kiari spoke to it. And they have another meeting today that you can follow on the web TV, UN web TV, just to be clear, because I said two at the Security Council. In fact, the other meeting I was referring to was the briefing of Assistant Secretary General Kiari. Albert.
Yes, hello, Albert Otti with DPH, German Press Agency. I have a question, an OCHA-related question on for Jens, on a follow-up on Gaza, two follow-up questions on Gaza. Number one, could you say specifically or explicitly whether the Israeli / Geneva Gaza Humanitarian Foundation scheme foresees any role for the UN or for OCHA? And if a role is foreseen, whether OCHA would participate or whether it would decline participation in this scheme. And the second question is about the diversion or alleged diversion of goods. As far as I understand, the Israelis are alleging, not necessarily that these are used directly for the fighters, but to that Hamas is selling civilian goods back, are diverting goods, then selling them back to civilians at inflated pricing, and are using that, the proceeds, to finance their fighters and their weapons. So has OCHA ever seen a diversion or such schemes happening on the ground? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, and nice to hear you in this briefing. On your first note, we have not seen any role foreseen for OCHA directly in this, and I think it should be, I hope by now, very clear that we are not participating in this, at least in the way it looks right now. But no reason to go to a flawed Plan B when we have a perfectly functioning Plan A, which is designed and to be implemented by the only ones who've actually done this during this war. I mean, how about listening to those people for a start? On your second point, it is true that that is an argument that it is being sold and the proceeds going to buy whatever can be bought. First of all, we have... It's kind of a non-problem, because we have very significant, robust methods in place to avoid and prevent aid diversions. We have monitoring of the distribution itself. We have monitoring what we call post-distribution. That is when it is with the people consuming or using the aid. We have things such as placing guards around our stockpiles to prevent that things are stolen. There are very robust mechanisms in place. And why is that so? First of all, because we need to make sure that the aid reaches those in need. That's our mandate. We're the first ones to insist that this must go to the people in need and no one else, civilians in need and no one else. Secondly, the donors would not pay us a cent if they were uncomfortable with us making sure that we that the mechanisms that we have ensured that. Okay, so there's a very direct link between the money we get and the reporting we deliver back to the donors, that we can prove that the tax dollars that you used for this went into the right bellies. Right, it's quite clear. I mean, we are talking about during the ceasefire where we had upwards of 800 trucks coming in every day. I cannot 100% sure say that nothing has been diverted. Nobody can do that in an operation anywhere. But it's not at a scale that justifies closing down an entire life-saving aid operation. If you had been in a coma for the last 3 years and you woke up and saw this for the first time, anyone with common sense would say, this is insane.
Thank you very much, Jens. Let me see, there was another hand, but yeah, Nick, I saw Nick.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I have a couple of questions for Jens and a question for Margaret. Jens, back on GHF, the Gaza Humanitarian Fund, we keep hearing that it's a US-backed scheme. What's your understanding of US support for this? Has there been formal communication either in New York or in Geneva from US authorities indicating that the UN and OCHA should be falling in line with this in some way, shape or form? The second question is, given how long the trucks have been piling up at the border waiting to come in, is there loss of food or medical supplies from deterioration because of climatic issues? And my question for Margaret is, my understanding is there are a couple of people who were evacuated medically this week. Is that correct? How many? And is there therefore a functioning channel for medical evacuations at this moment? Because we had the impression previously that there was very little going on in that department at all. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. I think you saw, as we all did, the U.S. ambassador, I believe, in Israel, who presented this plan. So one assumes that they are behind it, somehow promoting that. That's what I can say about that. Yes, there are perishables among in the stocks that are just outside of the border. I think Margaret can speak about medicine. I think that depends on, you know, cold chains and storage facilities and all that. And I'm sure that they are doing what they can to make sure that it's fit for use. But there has been certainly raised concern about foodstuff that cannot stand there forever because it will go bad at some point.
Yeah, Margaret, do you have more on that and maybe answer the other question?
Yes, indeed. And you're quite right. The medical supplies, we've got a lot of different things that need to come in, like vaccines, like insulin. All those things need to be stored appropriately. It's often a struggle anyway, even before the blockade, because we weren't allowed to use closed vehicles. And to really ensure a cold chain, you need to have closed refrigerated vehicles. So even knowing when you can bring things in, when things are to be able to plan to make sure you bring the right things in at the right time, we need an open channel. So again, this idea that there's going to be some kind of little humanitarian aid is nonsense in terms of health supplies. You require logisticians and people who really understand what's needed, where it's going. And again, I would emphasize this false narrative that this has to happen because there's aid diversion. In the health sector, we've not seen that. All we see is a desperate need at all times. We've never been able, it's always been a struggle to ensure we can get it in. The best time for us was when there was a ceasefire, so we could bring in much, much more, get it into our warehouses so we could then distribute it to the hospitals. And understand, essentially what we're bringing in is all that's available for healthcare now in Gaza. Before that wasn't the case, but because of this appalling situation, nothing else really was getting in. And now, of course, we are not being allowed to bring anything in either.
John?
Yes, good morning. I've got a question for Jens and also Margaret. Jens, you mentioned in the beginning that some of the refusals have included people with disabilities, if you could elaborate a little bit on that. And Margaret, if you can bring us up to date on the number of people killed and injured in Gaza and also in the West Bank, and if you have an updated figure from what you gave us last year, until May of 2024, I think there were about 4,000 amputees, many of them children. What is the figure 1 year forward? Thanks very much.
Jens?
Yeah, thanks, John. As you know, this flawed Plan B would see the number of distribution points reduced from the current 400 to about 4 or 5. Mm. That would mean that it would force people to move for long distances to pick up the aid and move back again. Now, people with disabilities, there are a lot of people with disabilities in Gaza because of the war, amputees and so on. How are they going to do that? How are you going to walk 20 miles if you don't have legs?
Margaret, and maybe also if you can answer the other part of Nick's question on medical evacuation, sorry.
Yeah, I just realized I hadn't. Yes, I'll start with the data I have on deaths and on injuries. So far, the data we have is that 52,928 people have been killed. And
can you repeat this? It came very blurred, sorry.
Oh, sorry, 50? Yes, my sound is no good. I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm having a horrible time with the internet here. 52,928 people have been killed. This is the data I have. And 119,846 people have been injured. Now, since 18 March, when the hostilities resumed, 2,749 people were killed and 7,607 injured, according to the Ministry of Health. So that's a subset of those other numbers I just gave you. On the medical evacuations, and sorry, Nick, I apologize. Indeed, on the 14th of May, 132 patients and 152 companions were evacuated from the European Gaza Hospital to Italy, Turkey, Romania, Jordan, and the UAE via the Kerem Shalom crossing. So yes, some evacuations can occur, and some people, workers can go in and out. It's very difficult, again, and this is a much reduced number and it's a very small amount of the people we need. So far, we've only had 255 patients in total evacuated since 18 March. And as I said last week, more than 10,000 patients, including approximately 4,500 children, need urgent medical care outside Gaza.
Thank you very much. Paula.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my question. Sorry if this was already asked. I entered into the meeting a little bit late, but I had a question for Margaret regarding the World Health Assembly. Can I ask that now? It's actually regarding the number of resolutions and decisions that are expected to be adopted. The other day at a briefing ahead of the World Health Assembly, we were told that there would be more than 40 resolutions and decisions being presented, which is not exactly the same as the 39 that were announced in February, that were approved in February at the executive executive meeting. I was just wondering what the number actually is, more than 40, and what the cost implications are, whether that's been revised.
Paula, okay, if you don't mind, can we just finish with Gaza, because there are still many, many hands up. So, Margaret, can you put this aside, if you don't mind, and then we will speak about WHA. So I guess John had a follow-up on his question about the numbers, about the figures, sorry.
Yes, Margaret, if you have an update on my question concerning the amputees in May 2024, I think it was around 4,000, including many children. What are the number of amputees from the information you're receiving from medical authorities and from your partners on the ground? Thank you.
Thanks, John. I don't have a specific update number on that. I will ask again for you, because I know, and it's a very important issue, because this is a lifelong you've taken somebody from normal mobility and reduced their mobility drastically. And not only that, they don't have access to limb reconstruction and all the things that might help someone return to a reasonably normal function at the moment. And we are aware that there are at least 1,000 children who have been made amputees by the bombardment, and that this is probably the highest number in the world. But I do not have any more specific figures for you. I will ask again to see. I think this is a difficult number to arrive at, because every day more and more people are rendered amputees.
Thank you very much. I guess Katrina's hand up is for the WHO. So I'll go back to the room where our question on Gaza still. Jamie and then Olivia.
Yeah, thanks. My question follows up on Nick's about the U.S. Role. Two questions. One is, there was apparently a briefing by a man named Arya Lightstone here in Geneva. You mentioned you didn't know formally or informally if there had been contacts, but are you aware of any meeting with this person who apparently was close to Steve Witkoff? So that's my first question. Just was OCHA involved in any way in that? And then second question is a more broad one. You speak here from this podium. There are talks quietly between this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. We had the USG at the Security Council talking about big words like genocide, right? My question is, and this is also for Alessandra, my question is, there have been a lot of different levels of communication on how to resolve the situation, the aid situation in Gaza. I haven't seen, and maybe I'm just not aware, that there have been at the very top level a type of communication. And let me just, if you can bear with me for 1 second, because we don't have any topics today, so I'm going to take the luxury of explaining. We're seeing in the world today, in a lot of places, how sort of individual leaders, there's this new theory of strong man or strong person leadership in the world, and maybe to the detriment of the rule of law or experts or structures. And so my question is, for the United Nations, the biggest personality, the biggest person in the entire family is Antonio Guterres. So all these different levels you've tried to resolve this humanitarian situation in Gaza. What about Antonio Guterres? Has he reached out to Donald Trump directly? Has he tried to make contact at that highest level? Because we see the USG, who's underneath the Secretary General, making these strong comments. Has Antonio Guterres tried to use the word genocide and explain the situation directly to Donald Trump, who's envoy for Middle East or, you know, subsidiary of his envoy for Middle East as involved? And just one last final point on this. The last time that I can recall, maybe there have been other instances, with the use of the word genocide was commonly used was with regard to Rwanda. And Rwanda, there's been a lot of navel gazing, whether it be President Clinton in the United States saying that he didn't do enough, or Kofi Annan or various others, that has there been an effort made to explain to President Trump that if genocide, and there's an argument as to whether or not that's the case, if genocide is happening in Gaza, that it would happen on his watch as President of the United States and on the watch of Antonio Guterres? Is that argument being made at the highest levels?
Okay, I'll say something about one and a half of your questions. So on the first one, I think I confirmed that there was a meeting by the gentleman you referred to, who I understand worked for in Witkoff's team, about this. And I confirmed we were there. It was not, I don't know where, how the meeting came about. We did participate, but remotely, not from Geneva. It was not in person in Geneva or anywhere else. It was remotely by a quite senior OCHA colleague. So that was the first one. So the other second one, half one, on your bit philosophical question, and I will let I will push it to Alessandra in a second. And I hope I don't say something or anything wrong, but I think the highest authority in the United Nations is we the peoples. We the peoples. And that is whom we are trying to convince now, as I said, that the situation at as it has developed now is so grotesquely abnormal that some popular pressure on leaders around the world needs to happen. We know it is happening. I'm not saying that people are silent, because they are not. But it doesn't appear that their leaders are listening to them.
Yeah. As Jan said, your question is there is a philosophical approach to it, but also something very concrete. You're speaking about people speaking out, and at the highest level at the United Nations. Jamie, from day one, the Secretary General has been speaking extremely, strongly about the situation in Gaza. I think he couldn't speak more. Yesterday, it was the last one when he gave a press conference with Chancellor Merz. He again repeated his appeal, his worries, there is, I have it here in front of me, incredible concern, and there is no way of solving this militarily. Whether this has been spoken or told to the highest level of the U.S. Administration, I don't know, but I know that we have been having constant contacts with the U.S. authorities, with the Israeli authority. I think Jens has said it very clearly. We can't speak more, and the U.S. and the other member states are present and participating in Security Council's meeting, where this situation is brought to the attention of the Council, of the authorities. So I really think that on the specific issue you're mentioning, I cannot give you a precise answer, because I don't know, I could ask, but I think we can just say that from day one, the worries of the United Nations, the activity of the United Nations, the situation of the United Nations staff, we've heard in this place and elsewhere how many people we've lost, yeah, also colleagues. So we have been speaking constantly about the situation, and there is a time issue now that we are repeating every day. Time is of essence here. So we really, really, really not stopping speaking about it at all level.
My question wasn't about speaking out. Let's be clear. And I know prepositions in English can be a little complicated. It's not about speaking out. It's about speaking with or to. And what I'm trying to find out is what measures, what steps, what entreaties, if you will, has the USG's office, the Secretary General's office, made to either the White House or to Benjamin Netanyahu recently to try to unravel this aid situation, which you guys are talking about so.
I think I'd stay, again, I cannot tell you the person with whom name, but I think I stand with my answer that we have been speaking to everyone that we could speak to, not only in the U.S. administration, in every administration, and at every level that the Secretary General has the power to address, we have been doing it. I had seen other hands in the room. Yes, Olivia, sorry, I said I would come to you, and then I think this is the last question on Gaza. We'll go to the WHA afterwards. Olivia.
Thank you. Jens, is OCHA essentially at risk of being totally cut out of coordinating aid in Gaza? Because just beyond the kind of point about distribution points, I see on their on their document that they've distributed, the GHF, saying that to expand reach and increase efficiency, GHF seeks to partner with NGOs, UN agencies, and civil society organisations to facilitate the movement and distribution of aid. And it also talks about organizing logistics, security, about having transparency frameworks. A lot of this sounds really like OCHA's role, no? So my question is that kind of at the root of your fear? And I guess a second part of that is that if you're unable to kind of have access and to coordinate, will NGOs essentially just be forced to kind of turn away from OCHA towards working with the GHF so that they can get their aid distributed? And I have a second question, but it's about Geneva-based roles, but we can come back to that perhaps after. Yes, about location of staff members' roles. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.
No, thanks, Olivia. There is an operation ongoing for, 18 months with OCHA, a key part of the coordination. We've done it. It's a fact. It's there. We're doing it. Right now, we are not doing much of it because it is blocked. And then there are a number of, I believe, press releases and statements coming out, some from this foundation, some from the Israeli authorities, some from US authorities, but it's statements and papers and a plan. We go with what works, and the NGOs are certainly with us, what works. And OCHA is a central part of that. As I said, we have not received any information about our potential involvement in this other plan. But we think it's a bad plan in any case. So we are not going to participate in it. It's also worth remembering the scale of these things. I saw at some point, but I can't confirm if that is correct, that they were talking about 68 truckloads per day. We're talking about getting 800 truckloads in per day during the ceasefire. We have to look at the scale of things. So one will address comprehensively the situation as it is now, and the second one is a cynical distraction from that.
Thank you very much. Olivia, we'll come back to you. Is that on Gaza? Yeah, go ahead.
Merci. Comme vous l'avez dit, Jens, tout à l'heure, vous avez parlé de cette organisation humanitaire basée à Genève. J'ai l'impression que vous argumentez la nécessité des Nations Unies, de l'Organisation des Nations Unies, comme quoi il y a quelque chose qui est solide, qui est déjà organisé pour acheminer les aides. Et vous rappelez que durant le cessez-le-feu, il y a eu ces mouvements et vous avez acheminé pas mal d'aides humanitaires. À mon avis, vous n'avez pas besoin d'argumenter votre nécessité. Mais on a l'impression que vous laissez tomber un aspect qui est vraiment nécessaire, à mon avis, c'est que, par exemple, l'UNRWA, la création de l'UNRWA a été créée, donc l'UNRWA a été créée en même temps de la création de l'État d'Israël. Et la création de l'UNRWA est liée au retour des Palestiniens à leur foyer. Donc, ce n'est pas vraiment une faveur que la communauté internationale, que les Nations Unies donnent aux Palestiniens, mais c'est une obligation. Et à mon avis, cet aspect-là qui couvre les pays qui ont signé la création de l'UNRWA en 1948 ou 49. Là, j'ai l'impression que vous laissez tomber. Est-ce que c'est vrai, ça? Donc, on ne parle plus de ça. On parle seulement comment acheminer les aides, la nécessité d'ouvrir le voie. Mais là, c'est une obligation internationale. Merci.
Et je pense que, enfin, Jens, tu pourras compléter, mais au contraire, ça, je pense que la question qu'on a mentionnée plusieurs fois, je pense que Tom Fletcher l'a fait, mais même avant, depuis le début, on a toujours dit, si on ne peut pas, nous, on essaye de faire tout ce qu'on peut pour pouvoir porter cette aide. Si on n'y arrive pas, parce qu'on est empêché, c'est les occupying powers, je ne sais pas comment on dit en français, qui a la responsabilité de ça, selon les droits humanitaires internationaux. Donc, au contraire, l'UNRWA a 13 000 personnes à Gaza. Ils sont là. Ils sont là et ils peuvent donner cette aide humanitaire. Le problème, c'est le faire entrer. Et si on n'arrive pas à le faire entrer, c'est évident qu'on ne peut pas les distribuer. Je pense que Jens l'a dit de façon très claire. Donc, le problème, ce n'est pas que UNRWA est... quelle est la position de UNRWA? UNRWA est là, nous, on est là. Les humanitaires sont là. Il y a toute une organisation. Le problème, c'est qu'on n'a pas accès. L'aide n'a pas accès. Et donc, c'est clair, et on l'a dit plusieurs fois, y compris au Conseil de sécurité, la responsabilité de... la distribution de l'aide, de faire survivre ces populations et vivre ces populations, elle revient à l'occupant. Donc, je pense que ça a été dit très, très clairement. Enfin, je ne sais pas, Jens, si tu veux ajouter quelque chose.
Non,
Pardon, Moussa, dites. Oui.
Ce que je voulais dire, c'est bon. Ce que vous dites, on revient à la même, au point de départ. Ce qu'il y a, c'est que on est en train d'argumenter la nécessité de ces organisations humanitaires des Nations Unies par le besoin d'aujourd'hui. Or, à mon avis, on parle du fondement des Nations Unies. Donc, si on ne peut pas respecter cette résolution de 1949 qui a créé l'UNRWA pour... et son but, c'est acheminer les aides jusqu'au retour. Là, on est en train de casser les Nations Unies.
Alors... Évidemment, ce que vous dites est tout à fait correct, mais je pense que une des choses qu'on a dit de façon constante depuis le début, mais qu'on dit depuis 80 ans, c'est qu'il faut qu'on trouve une solution politique. Le secrétaire général l'a dit encore hier, c'est pas avec des opérations militaires qu'on va résoudre cette question. Il y a eu des innombrables résolutions du Conseil de sécurité de l'Assemblée générale où la solution à deux États a été acceptée et c'est la position des Nations Unies. Comme vous dites, ça c'est une position de base. Et ça, on va continuer à travailler sur ça autant que faire se peut. Je vous lis les mots du secrétaire général de hier. Hier, il a dit ça parce que justement, il a parlé de la question de comment trouver une solution aussi au-delà de la solution contingente de l'urgence de maintenant. Et il a dit « I believe we need to find exactly the same things I mentioned in my intervention » où il se référait donc à cette solution à des États « in order to be able to look for a future in which one day Israelis and Palestinians will be able to live side by side in two states that respect each other and which the security of all states is guaranteed. » Donc, nous, cette question-là reste sous les tapis et à côté de ça, évidemment, maintenant, il y a une situation d'urgence et de laquelle aussi on s'occupe. C'est pas l'une ne doesn't supersede the other. Les deux ne s'excluent pas. Il faut travailler sur les deux. Il y a une situation d'urgence d'aide humanitaire et ça, je pense que Jens a bien expliqué. Et de l'autre côté, comme le secrétaire général l'a dit hier, on doit continuer à travailler aussi sur ce que vous dites est les fondements. On le croit de la solution de la situation dans cette région du monde. Imen, et puis je voudrais passer au point suivant. Imen, allez-y.
Oui, juste une information, si vous pouvez la confirmer. En fait, il y a plusieurs sites et plusieurs médias qui parlent que la composition de cette organisation, il y a des anciens officiers des Nations Unies. Est-ce que vous pouvez confirmer l'information? Et si c'est vrai, ça GHF, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, qu'il y a des former officers from the United Nations. Et si c'est vrai, ça touche incroyablement les crédibilités des Nations Unies. Est-ce que vous pouvez confirmer, commenter ça?
Je pense que ça, c'est tout à fait une question que vous devez leur poser, et pas à nous. Catherine, j'avais mis Catherine en attente, mais il y avait aussi une question de la part de... Oui, Olivia, tu avais... Mais est-ce que, si ça ne vous embête pas, on essaye d'aller vers WHA parce qu'il y avait plusieurs questions pour Margaret. Comme ça, je peux libérer Margaret et puis on revient. Donc, Catherine, je crois que Paula has asked you a question on WHA and then Catherine also had one. So maybe you want to answer Paula's question on WHA, Margaret,
sure.
And then we will go to others.
Sure. Yeah, Paula, indeed, we start with resolutions in the executive board, but we do get more resolutions. Member states can develop a resolution right up until to the wire. But so we know that we've got over 40 resolutions to consider, and they're on all sorts of things. We've got a lot on universal health coverage. We've got a lot on communicable diseases. We've got a lot on health care and workforce. We've got on resolutions on children's and adolescents' health. And yes, indeed, when we're asked to do a huge amount of work, it is difficult when we've got a much reduced budget. But and you'll probably hear those discussions during the WHA. It'll be a very, very interesting World Health Assembly this year.
Merci beaucoup, Catherine.
Yes, okay.
I have a question. In fact, I'm conveying as president of ATANU a question or questions regarding the access of WHO on Sunday, when the election of the new director of WHO Afro will take place. Are correspondents, reporters allowed to go to WHO? Do we need to call or contact anyone? Now, regarding WHA taking place in the Palais, you told us that we don't need any extra badge to access the Palais, that is for sure. Now, where are the meetings taking place? Is it in room 20, in room 19, in room 18? What kind of access do we have? Is it like last year, where there is a couple seats booked for press? And in that case, could you make sure that the seats are really available for press? All these logistic questions. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you. That's a lot of logistic questions. So coming to the WHO premises, they do ask that you inform, that we need to inform security and that we need to put it into check guards. I'm sorry about that. We don't like it either, because it creates a lot of work, not just for you, but for us. But that is the current situation. That is the current position. The Afro election, there will be live streamed. All the candidate interviews, you know, the candidate presentations will be live streamed, as will the announcement of the successful candidate. So you will have access to all of that. On the what room, where, that will always, as normal, be in all the different journals. And indeed, I know it's a constant problem ensuring that the press have the seats and have the tables at the front. You know, we do sit there and we fight civil society on your behalf, but we also need you to turn up. So what happens is that if there are empty seats, quite often, if we go out for 5 minutes, we suddenly find that half the civil society has invaded the press spots. So please use those spots. We will keep as many as we can, because we, especially when we know we've got huge moments like the adoption of the, you know, the on the pandemic agreement, with that will be a very big moment either on Monday or Tuesday. So we know that you will want to be there in person, and we will be there in person to protect that space, but we do need you to actually come and take that space.
Maybe if I can also add some information about the access, because that's what our security has organized for the conference time. So just to inform you that the security tell us that for the pedestrian entrances, access to the Palais des Nations through the Pregny and Peace Gates may be slower than usual from 8 a.m. to 12 noon on Monday 19 and Tuesday 20th of May for the conference. Therefore, it is recommended to use the Chemin de Fer gate instead. For vehicle, for cars, access to the Palais des Nations through the Pregny gates. This can also be quite congested through Monday and Tuesday. It is therefore recommended to use Chemin de Fer gate during this period. And they also, the security also says that should the maximum parking occupancy of the Palais des Nations be reached, security and safety services reserve the right to eventually temporarily refuse vehicle access for safety reasons. So maybe come early if you can. And of course, we also have congestions at the Pass NID unit at the Pregny Pavilion those days. So they will not process issuance or renewal of vehicle badges for these 2 days. Therefore, if you need to change your badge for any reasons, just do it, well, maybe today or after the starting from Wednesday. This is what I have from security for Monday and Tuesday. Paula, you have a follow-up, and Catherine too, I see.
Yes, Margaret, hi. Could you answer, Ashley, my question regarding the additional estimated costs for those new resolutions and decisions that were submitted?
I haven't got any. There's no way I could give you that information. That has, until we've got the resolutions, until we've got the program, you look at the cost. But at the moment, you know, the resolutions haven't been agreed. So no, there hasn't been a costing on that. And I wouldn't be able to give you that number.
Margaret. Yes, thank you. Yes.
Yeah, Catherine, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Alessandra, thank you for all the details of security. And again, I'd like to come back as ACANU president about logistic issues, about correspondents who are having a UN badge with a purple P or what they call red P. There are still a lot of problems as security doesn't recognize these badges as a permanent press badges. So if you could make sure that there's a good internal communication for security to know that it corresponds to UN permanent non-resident press, and also the issue of parkings for correspondents, would it be possible exceptionally maybe for the two first days to give access to the inner court parkings, which are free. And I recall to the Geneva ACANU members that kindly UNIS and security put at disposal to drop off parking places in the inner courtyard. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that for the red P badges with pleasure. For what concerns parking, I would be surprised that given the amount of people that will come to the Palais on Monday and Tuesday, I would be really surprised if we could have an exceptional access there. However, as you have said, we have made available these two spots for discharging material reserved to the press. So that is something that people can use if they really have heavy equipment to park temporarily in the internal court in these two spaces. And of course, if you need more information about that, don't hesitate to ask ACANU or us at UNIS. I think that these were the two questions. Agnes and then Jamie.
Yes, hi. Hi, Margaret. Sorry to bother you with logistics questions. For Sunday on the Africa election, do you know at what time it will be exactly, and if you plan to send a press release, and when? For Monday, in which room will be the plenary, and at what time it will open? Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, looking at the, we'll start, we definitely will be sending a press release. So that's easy one to answer. I'm pretty sure, but you would get it from the African region. It's expected to start at 9:00. That's the opening of the meeting. 9:15 to 9:30, we've got adoption of the provisional agenda. And then the interesting bit for you really is the when the nomination of the is the interview session. I'm just looking for the session when we get to hear from the candidates, and that will be is the afternoon open meeting. I've just lost it, but it's middle of the sort of session will be when the candidates actually present their interventions. It's very strange. I had it sitting in front of me and I can't see exactly the time. Let me see if I've got it here. Sorry, apologies for being a bit slow. I had it all set up and it seems to have disappeared. But anyway, yeah, middle of the session is basically the interesting time when you will see the different candidates present their present their position and why they should be the person who is elected. The interview session, I see it now, 10:15 to 1:15 is where it's set down. So that's really probably the most interesting time, and that's the one that will be live streamed and open.
Jamie? Sorry.
Yes, and for Monday for the WHA, where will be the plenary? Which room? Mm. I guess you could tell us that. And with the timing, I'm sorry, on the internet, on the website, there is no timing and anything.
I'm going, Fidelo has very kindly said she's also going to even look into the money for Paula, even though I'm pretty confident that's not been a costing that we can make easily. But I'll just ask Fidelo also, she's watching, if she knows what room it's in, because I don't have that information in front of me either. So at the moment, I can't give that to you, but, you know, we'll pass it on that you all want to know the room.
Hi, Margaret.
For the plenary.
Can you hear me, Margaret?
Yeah, I can hear you, Jamie.
Great. Hi, thanks. We got a couple of logistical questions. I'll get back to the bigger, broader political question for you. We're heading into WHA, obviously. It's been a bit of a topsy-turvy start to the year for the UN Health Agency. How much is WHO facing an existential crisis as this WHO opens? And particularly in light of the budgetary cuts by its largest donor, but also maybe by others, as well as the announcement just a couple of days ago with some changes at the top level. For a very broad public, as we're opening this WHA, what kind of crisis, how severe is the crisis that WHO is facing?
Those are appealing terms, but WHO definitely, clearly faces a funding problem, big problem. But crisis is opportunity. And as a result, Dr. Tedros and the senior team have really accelerated what they were looking to do anyway, which is make us leaner, more nimble. And you've seen already, and it's been done top down. So cutting where we can, reducing the costs, staff costs at the top, but making sure that we can still do the work that we need to do. I think the mantra that you're hearing throughout is less with less, but we won't do any less than is necessary. In other words, we will continue our core function. And indeed, those will be very big discussions at the World Health Assembly. What bits absolutely must be done with the less that we have to do it with.
Sorry, thanks, Margaret. I'm just looking at the remarks from the PBAC a couple days ago. Yesterday was today. 2 days ago. And obviously there was a bit of a change from what I've been hearing from the PBAC in January, which was a little bit more concerning, let's say. But there's an important line in there that says there's an anticipated budget, even with the reductions that you're planning for the biennial, that there's still an anticipated budget gap of more than $1.7 billion. How much do you expect that this WHA is going to produce commitments towards mopping up that budget gap?
We are actually expecting to have a financing dialogue. I think that's going to be Monday or Tuesday, but we're hoping to hear from various potential donors or donors about exactly that, how they are going to step up and help with the gap.
Katrina, I saw your question in the chat, but maybe you want to ask it yourself.
Thank you again, Alessandra. It is regarding the link to the election of WHO Afro. Last time when it took place, it was very difficult to find it because it was on the WHO Afro website and they did post it late. So could you please make sure that we get it in advance?
Yeah, in fact, I'll just try and find it and stick it in the chat as well, but also provide it for the notes from this meeting. So I have got that link.
Oh, okay. That's so sweet of you. Thank you, Margaret.
No problem. That's an easy one. Thank you.
Yeah, and let's have it also for the notes, because not everybody has access to the chat if they're in the room, Margaret. That's the problem with the people in the room.
Yeah.
Okay, so it looks like we can finish with you, Olivia. Please.
On an unrelated note, this one is open to everybody listening in, except Margaret. I think I'm okay. I don't need your response, but thank you very much for all the other notes and briefing today. It's just about an article that was in our colleagues Le Temps. They did an article yesterday about the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights looking to move out a number of their staff members to other locations. Could OCHA, UNCTAD and UNHCR please outline what plans they are looking at the moment in terms of considering moving staff out of Geneva to other country bases, and can you please confirm or deny if those things are being looked at right now across those three agencies? Thank you.
So if I understand well, you want the answers from the people present here, not specifically on HCHR, because I know they've been speaking and they have been answering questions from journalists on the article. So I would refer you to them. But then I'll give the floor to the other colleagues who are present here. Who wants to start?
Yeah, thanks, Olivia. I'm afraid I'll have to give you a bit of a bureaucratic answer because there are no specifics. We are looking at, within the context of what we call the humanitarian reset, which is, of course, the wider humanitarian community, looking at what is OCHA's role and what are OCHA's core functions and how are we going to, you know, sustain them and bring them forward. And that includes what staff, which functions, and where they're going to be. So just to say that, of course, where people are is part of that broader thinking, but nothing has landed yet.
There was Eugene on the line. Let's see if she's still there to answer for UNHCR.
Hi, Alessandra, I'm here.
Yes, I can see you and hear you. Hi, Eugene.
Sorry, Olivia, I have to give a very similar answer that reviewing and then the process of decision on those location, etc., is still ongoing. For UNHCR as well. It's not decided yet. So I think once we have a clear answer, of course, we will communicate with you more clearly. But at this time of the day, moment, that nothing is clear, and then there's not much information I can share at the moment.
Who was your third interlocutor? UNCTAD, okay. No, that's what I had to understood. Cathy.
Oui, bonjour Olivia. Bonjour à tous. Non, je n'ai pas d'informations particulières à donner sur ce qui va se passer dans le secteur développement, économie et développement. Pour ce qui concerne la CNUSED, les mesures de restriction budgétaire ont été prises sur les voyages, principalement sur les frais de fonctionnement. On se serre la ceinture. Mais je n'ai pas d'autres informations précises à donner sur un nombre de postes où, pour le moment, on n'a pas d'informations à ce sujet. Voilà.
Olivia, la CNUSED fait partie du secrétariat. Et donc, en fait, les mesures, comme tu l'as vu, hein, on l'a dit, je pense, à plusieurs reprises, il y a toutes ces propositions qui sont en train d'être discutées sur les duty stations, sur les efficacités à trouver à un niveau des clusters. Tout ça, c'est en discussion. Donc, la CNUSED fait partie de ces discussions-là, comme tout le reste du secrétariat. Donc, pour ça, effectivement, on n'a pas vraiment de réponse immédiate. En tout cas, on continuera à vous informer.
Si je peux juste ajouter, concernant la CNUSED, l'ensemble du staff est à Genève. C'est le siège de l'organisation. On a très peu de présence sur le terrain, en bureau opérationnel sur le terrain. On a un tout petit bureau à Addis Abeba pour l'Afrique et un bureau de représentation, bien sûr, à New York. Donc, voilà.
Et les personnels de projet,
bien sûr, mais principalement donc la
grande, grande majorité du personnel est ici. La secrétaire générale, donc Rebecca Greenspan, coordonne la réflexion sur la réorganisation de ce, je ne sais plus comment c'est appelé, pas un cluster, mais oui, de cette, un cluster de développement. Oui, la réflexion se fait sous sa direction, avec d'autres partenaires. Oui, on les a dans un document que je peux partager. Merci.
Je peux te donner le nom exact du cluster. D'autres questions? Non. Alors, pour un briefing qui n'avait pas, for briefing that didn't have topics, we have had lots of topics. So thank you very much for being with us for this briefing. Just a little note that, sorry. We have spoken about the 17th of May as World Telecommunication and Information Society Day, but it's also, and I am looking for it, can't find it, the International Day, if I'm not wrong, the right title is Against Homophobia, and we have sent you the statement of the Secretary General for this day, which is also the 17th of May. I think that's it for the moment for today. Thank you very much. I'll see you on Tuesday, and let's hope that Monday, Margaret, will be as good as possible on logistics. Keep us informed, please, and Fadela. Thank you very much to everyone. Have a nice weekend. Oh, John, I see John's hand, last minute hand. Go ahead.
Yes, Alessandra, perhaps I missed it in the beginning, but has there been any announcement about any ceremony in the Palais on Monday?
Ceremony?
A ceremony concerning the renovations.
Okay. Tu me poses une colle là.
Okay.
Not that I am aware of, but I will ask. And if you can give me a couple of more information on what you're really thinking of, because I had a ceremony for the renovation. I don't see exactly what you mean, but let's, if you have more information, let me know, but I'll ask maybe something that is not on my radar, with pleasure. Because
Alessandra,
on Monday we will
be
very
WHO.
Busy. Pardon me? Margaret?
Alessandra, it might be WHO.
If it's WHO, then of course, I'll leave Margaret trans, because I would be surprised that with the beginning of the World Health Assembly, we also have a big commemoration, something else. So maybe Margaret, you have any news on that?
Yes, we do. So there will be our old building that's been renovated, that had all the asbestos taken out and everything, is finally done. And there's going to be a little ceremony just before the Swiss Missions traditional event. And so there'll be a ceremony up at WHO, and you'll be sent some details soon.
Thank you very much, Margaret, for this information. Yes, indeed. Okay, so you have your answer, John. Happy. Any other last minute hand? No, I don't see any. So thank you very much. Bon weekend. I'll see you on Tuesday, and good luck for Monday. Bye.